Let's take our Bibles, go to Esther chapter number one this morning. Esther chapter number one. If you're physically able, stand with me. We're going to begin another short series. We just came out of the book of Ruth. I found that a profitable and helpful series. And now we're going to jump over and work a little bit through the book of Esther. We're certainly not going to deal with every portion of this book. It's not my intentions in going into it. But really just to look at an overview and probably four or five sermons out of the book of Esther. So we're going to begin our reading, of course, in chapter number one and verse number one. Our entire text this morning will be the first couple of chapters. But for sake of time, I'm only going to read about the first nine verses. Esther chapter number one. Bible says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this is Ahasuerus, "which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the noble and princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 84 days. And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where were white and green and blue hangings, fastened with cords and fine linens and purple, to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black and marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and the royal wine in abundance, according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house, which belonged to King Ahasuerus." Let's pray. Father, thank you for the opportunity once again to be in your word, and I thank you for the opportunity to start this new series. Lord, I believe it's a timely series in the lives of many of those that are sitting here today, and so we pray your hand would be upon these next few moments as, Lord, we navigate through these first two chapters. And Lord, recognize what it's there for and how it applies to our life. Thank you for every individual that has been faithful to be in your house this morning. And I pray that you'd use this time to be an encouragement and a help to them. In Jesus' precious name, amen. You may be seated. It's told a long time ago that if you want to be successful in this life, you need to learn to read. They said it this way: readers are leaders, and leaders are readers. And so make certain that you're always reading. And so I have attempted throughout my ministry to be very disciplined in the area of reading and just staying on top of some of the newer books. And so I recently came across a book and it had a good quote in it, and I thought I'd show you that quote today. It was just a real help and encouragement to me. Yeah. Where's Waldo? How many of you have ever seen Where's Waldo? Now, we're not going to leave that up there long because you'd spend the rest, some of you have already found Waldo, but the rest of you are going to spend the entire time trying to find Waldo, and you're not going to hear a word that I say. Those books are so, so annoying to me. We had them around the house for the longest time, and I would sit there in my recliner, and I'd just be looking at them, and I'd spend forever trying to find Waldo. And one of my kids would come up over my shoulder, "It's right there, Dad." And I'm like, "Of course that's where he is. I was just looking at all the other pictures." How they can find Waldo so quick, I don't know. If you don't know Where's Waldo, it's a picture book, and there's this little man, and he's hidden in every scene, and it's your job to find him. And sometimes, if you're like me, you can look for seemingly a long, long time and never find Waldo. I've concluded on some of the pages, he's just not there. It is just not possible he's in this picture. I have searched it from every corner, at every angle. There's no way he's there. But they tell me he's there. Whether I can see him or not, he's most definitely in that picture. You know, so much of what happens in our world, so much of what is happening in our world, even today, from biblical times all the way through to current events, they appear to many of the observers to just simply be random and completely out of control events, which would cause all of us to say, okay, wait a second, where's God in that? I read through my Bible and I see things that are happening and I think to myself, okay, God, where are you in this situation? Where are you in this individual's life? And it's that same thought is true all the way to today as I look at things that go on in the lives of many of the church members. I look at what's going on in our world and I question and ask in sincerity, not in criticism, not being critical toward God, but I ask in sincerity, God, I don't quite understand where you are in all of this. I look at the wars that are going on, and I look at Russia, and I look at little Ukraine, and I look at what Vladimir Putin is doing to this country, and it seems absolutely so senseless to me, and innocent, wonderful people who have done nothing wrong are dying in this senseless world, war, and I can't help but just kind of sit back and say, all right, God, I don't understand. I don't understand this. Where are you? We see a hurricane come up and do so much destruction to our own country. Take over 100 lives. And we have to ask ourselves, God, where are you in that? I don't understand how you can just sit back and let innocent lives be lost over a storm that you're in control of. Where are you in this? Some of you in this auditorium are going through trials. You're going through some things in your home, in your personal life, in your families right now, and you are questioning, and it would cause me even to say, God, I don't understand this. I don't understand where you are and how you're allowing this to happen. As our world seemingly is coming apart at the seams, inflation is rising, financial struggles, broken relationships, all of those leave us scratching our head and saying, all right, God, I'm looking at this big picture and you promised me you're there, that you're in every picture, but I just can't seem to find you in this one. A man by the name of Albert Camus, he said, we see life as absurd when we understand the confrontation between human need and the unreasonable silence of the world. That we look at this world that we're living in and we conclude this is all just absurd when we realize what humanity needs, and yet it seems to be so much silence on the behalf of our Creator. If this world is directed by God, why do so many things that happen seem to appear so pointless? I think it's this thinking and along this line of thinking that prepares us as we enter into this study of the book of Esther. Let me give you just a little bit of background, if you would, and it helps to set the stage of where we are in Bible history. In 597, a king of Israel by the name of Jehoiakim, he attempted a revolt against Nebuchadnezzar and lost in great fashion because of their godless ways, which led to the first carrying away of the Jewish people into captivity. It wasn't just but about 10 years later that another king entered on the scene by the name of Zedekiah. And once again, he ignored the prophecies of the prophet Jeremiah and the prophecies of the other prophets that were around him. And he decided, no, I'm going to go after Nebuchadnezzar and I'm going to stop him once and for all. And this time Nebuchadnezzar was relentless. Not only did Israel suffer defeat, but Judah was leveled. The temple was destroyed, the walls were destroyed, Jerusalem was destroyed. And so they're going through this time in the history of the nation of Israel where they're facing great destruction. And during that destruction, Nebuchadnezzar, one time after another, just began to carry the Jews away to his land of Syria. That's where we open up the passage. Now, it's years later, Cyrus has been the king over Syria. Now Cyrus is dead, and now his grandson, Xerxes, in Hebrew form, Ahasuerus, he is on the throne and he's ruling. And we've already read these first 9 verses. Stay with me for just a moment as we lay some background. But we've already established in these first 9 verses a little bit about this king Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus was a larger in life than life king. The empire's boundaries by the time Ahasuerus came on the scene, I mean, it was beyond massive, especially in comparison to so many of the other nations of that day. Ahasuerus and his reign was just absolutely extreme. The Bible talks about how it was from India, even to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. He was the premier ruler of that day. You think about how small the sliver of the promised land really is in the Bible and compared to the globe. And you think about this and the capital city that this king would have ruled over. The narrator is going to great lengths to show us how massive the rule of Ahasuerus is. In fact, he says this, that he spent and brought in all of his princes, all of his rulers over all of these provinces, and he wanted to show off his great nation where he governed over, and it took him 180 days to show off just how impressive he was. The reader, as we read this, we're supposed to be impressed. We're supposed to immediately see that Ahasuerus is a man with great power. He was a king who could do whatever he wanted to do. Now, I know what we do sometimes, and I want to just clear this up. We read the book of Esther, and we think about this sweet little princess girl Esther, and we think that this is just this great little fairy tale. But I'm telling you, as we begin to pull back a little bit behind the pages, and we begin to look back behind the curtains of this scene, you're going to find that this isn't a fairy tale at all. This Ahasuerus was not a good man. This Ahasuerus was a very, very, very powerful dictator that did what he wanted to do, that got what he wanted to have, and you don't have to read in great depth to know that the things going on in his kingdom, they were not godly at all. Did you see even in verse number 6, it talked about all the things and this great party that he threw? And it talks about how the beds were of gold and silver. That's just giving us a small indication of the immorality that's taking place on in this kingdom. That the writer is drawing our attention and saying, hey, not only was this a big party, but you have to understand this party wasn't just out in the streets and it wasn't just out in the castle and in the main dining areas of where he lived. No, this party was immoral and it lasted for 7 days after the 180 days of looking over the kingdom. He brings them all back and he says, for 7 days we're going to party and we are going to do whatever our hearts desire to do. And for 7 days they do. The Bible talked about the drinking in that passage. That none, how did it put it? And the drinking was according to the law. You say, well, so they were all law-abiding citizens. Right, because King Ahasuerus removed all laws that would limit any type of drinking, any type of drunkenness. He removed everything and he says, there's only one law for these next 7 days. And that is you do whatever you find the most pleasure in doing. That's what he does. And so he's having this incredible party. And the Bible says in verse number 10, on the seventh day when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bithah, Harbona, Bigtha, Agabitha, Zether, Carcass, his seven chamberlains. He tells them in verse 11 to bring Vashti, the queen, before the king with the crown royal to show the people and their princes her beauty, for she was fair to look upon. I was about to just say, hey, it's just rain, but we're in Lubbock, so there's no such thing as just rain. We're all like, whoa, that's like rain. Really, it is. So here's what's going on. Stay with me. 7 days, they're partying. 7 days of drunkenness. 7 days of extreme immorality. And now the king has decided in verse number 10, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go get Vashti, the queen. This is a weird type of relationship that in those days that the king had with the queen. And so they would have lived even in separate places. And he said, I'm going to go and get Vashti, and I'm going to bring her here, and we're going to finish this party. I mean, we're going to finish it right. Make no mistake about it. What Ahasuerus was doing here, he was not looking for just a meet and greet. He was not looking to just bring Vashti in before the princes and the noblemen and say, hey, I want you to meet my wife, the queen. I want you to meet the queen. No, if you understand at all this first chapter and just the depths of depravity that are there, you understand that he is going to make the type of request that an ancient Near Eastern warrior king would expect to make. He was not just bringing her out to say, hey, everybody, meet the queen. He had some really, really sick plans in mind for Vashti, which is why Vashti said, yeah, I don't think I'm going to come out there for that. No, all of you have been drinking for 7 days. I've seen what's going on in your party over there, and it's nothing I want to have a part of. And so I'm not going to be a part of this. And the purpose of pointing that out in the text is not so that we would see the integrity necessarily so much of Vashti, but what the biblical author wanted us to see was, again, just how corrupt Ahasuerus was, that he would be willing to bring the queen out and to do things that would just absolutely humiliate her in front of the crowds. Well, in verse number 13, the king gets very upset, and he does what any impulsive king that is enraged by insubordination would do. He decides, oh, I'm done with Vashti. She's not going to be the queen anymore. And he calls his cabinet together, and he begins to bring them in. And just by the pure insanity of the things that they're saying, it tells me they're probably still very heavily intoxicated. Look at verse number 16 with me. Here their cabinet's now gathered together. Vashti's refused. And in verse 16, Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes, when it shall be reported, the king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen not to be brought before him, but she came not. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes, we have heard of the deed of the queen, thus shall there arise much contempt and wrath. So the cabinet comes together, and I wouldn't normally use these words, but these guys are pretty chauvinistic, and I mean, they're your typical chauvinistic pigs. They're like, oh, Vashti doesn't want to come out before the king? Well, let me tell you what the problem is, Ahasuerus. If she can stand up to you, and she can just refuse to do what you tell her to do, here's the problem, sir. Now, our wives, when we go home, they're going to do the same thing to us, and there's just going to be this huge feminist breakout in our country, and before long, the women are going to be running this country. I don't like this at all, and you can just tell they're very upset, so they're like, here's what we're going to do. Out with Vashti, and we'll go get ourselves a new and a better king, queen. And so in verse 19, that's the plan. If it please the king, listen to this. Let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the law of the Persians and of the Medes, that it not be altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate to another that is better than she." And so that's the plan. We're going to go, we're going to get rid of Vashti, and we're going to find a new queen. So that's where the search begins, is in chapter number 2. That brings us to the next scene. And if you thought chapter number 1 was disturbing, I'm telling you, chapter 2 is even more so disturbing. Look at verse 2 of chapter 2. "Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in the province, in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hege the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them, and let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so." You got to understand this. This is where the fairy tale part of this story, if you have it in your mind, it begins to break down. They begin to go throughout the entire kingdom. They begin to gather up any young lady that they thought would be attractive at all to the king, or pleasing at all to the king. You have to understand, they were not coming back to the palace and the capital city to enter a beauty contest. No, they are being taken from their families. They're being trafficked into a massive harem of power-hungry king, so that he can use them however he wants. He would take each of these young ladies that was brought to him. He would dehumanize them. He would make them an object, maybe for a day. And if he didn't like him, he would send them on his way. And they would live as a part of his harem for the rest of their lives, maybe to never see the king again. I just don't want to downplay what's going on here, because if you do, you're going to miss the message of this book. See, this story is not bypassing the horrific experience of God's people. It's diving headlong into them. And what you have to understand that's going on here, it is not a pleasant scene at all. So when we come to chapter or verse number 5, and we come to Esther, we have to find out that she's entering into a very, very ugly place. Verse 5, "Now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah." So that first king, "whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he brought up Mordecai, this man, brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother was dead, took her for his own daughter." So in chapter 2, as we get into this section, the plot begins to thicken, because finally a Jew enters into the scene. And it tells us about this man by the name of Mordecai. Mordecai is raising his much younger cousin. We don't know everything about Esther's story, but again, it causes us to kind of scratch our head and think, why does this young lady have to deal with so much in her life? Evidently, according to this text, she had been orphaned. We don't know exactly how her mom and dad had died. It is likely, and most would believe, that when Jeconiah led that revolt against Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar came down and a battle broke out, that it was very likely that her mom and dad died in that battle. The rest of them were carried away, and it just so happened that Mordecai was carried away, and he brought along his much younger cousin, Esther. She's lost her family. Esther is in a place where she's been taken and stripped out of her homeland. She's living with what many would say a distant relative, but a good relative in Mordecai. And so she is brought there. And now, as this search is going throughout all of the kingdom to find a new queen for Ahasuerus, somewhere along the line they pass by Esther. Esther's lost her mom and dad. Esther's been stolen away from her own country. Esther's being forced to live with her much older cousin in a strange land. And now here she is, you got to get this, in this strange land. And all of a sudden one day, somebody from the king's court comes by and sees her and says, whoa, she's pretty. And forces her to leave her home away from home, forces her to leave Mordecai and enter in to the king's harem and wait her day to be brought before Ahasuerus. I'm not trying to be gross here, but to be put in a place where she would do whatever, whenever Ahasuerus wanted her to do. Completely everything out of her control. Where's God in that? Where's God in this? What's Esther ever done wrong that she would be brought before the king? And what Esther do to lose her parents at a young age? What Esther do to be stolen away from her homeland? What did Esther do outside of just being a pretty young lady that caused her to be stripped from the only home that she knew and taken in and said, for the next year, you're going to prepare, and at any moment, you might be called to go in before the king. And as the story goes, her day came. She was brought before the king. And just like every one of the fair young virgins that had been rounded up, when her time came, she entered into the king's chambers, and whatever it was that the king told her to do, she was forced to do. And then sent back. The text ends in verse number 21 and 20 through 23, where we're at. We're going to come back more to Esther in that part of the story. But the last part of it is this. In those days while Mordecai, he was so concerned for Esther. In those days while Mordecai sat at the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlain, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door were wroth and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the thing was known by Mordecai. So Mordecai's sitting in the gate. This is the way this portion of the story ends. He's standing in the gate, and he hears these two men, Bible says, Bigthan and Teresh, and he hears them talk of a plot to kill King Ahasuerus. You say, well, why ever would they want to kill King Ahasuerus? Well, I'll tell you this. History tells us, and I didn't even realize this until study this week, but history tells us that Ahasuerus was eventually assassinated by one of his military leaders because he had one too many times had an affair with one of his military leader's wives. I'm just telling you, Ahasuerus was like bigger than life. He saw it, he took it, he wanted it, he had it. That's the type of man. And so I don't know exactly what he did, but in my mind, I think that these two men, as they're plotting to kill Ahasuerus, they're probably justified in what they're planning to do to this wicked king. But instead, Mordecai hears of it, and he does the right thing. He tells Esther. Esther runs and certifies in Mordecai's name and says, you better watch out, these two guys. They do an inquiry of it and come to find out, yeah, sure enough, these two men want to kill him. And so Ahasuerus, no, this is his kingdom. Nobody's going to do that. And so they're hung and put to death. So here's the question I have for you. What's the point of all this? What is this message? What is the message of these opening scenes of the book of Esther? I want you to notice that as we've walked through very rapidly, I might add, through these opening scenes, have you noticed how different they are to the rest of the Old Testament that we read? There's some things missing in these first two chapters. Did you notice we got nothing about miracles? We heard nothing of prophecies. We heard nothing about the Jewish people and God's plan for the Jewish people to be in power. We saw nothing about a temple or a tabernacle. So the leader, this leads the reader, all of us, as we go through this, to ask this question. where's God in these first two chapters? In fact, did you know that God's never mentioned one time in the entirety of the book of Esther? No, no, stay with me here. I'm going somewhere with this. Where is God when a little Jewish girl loses her mom and dad? Where is God when a little orphan Jewish girl not only loses her parents, but is stripped away from her only home and taken to a strange land? Where is God when an impulsive, corrupt, immoral king is on the throne, doing whatever it is that he wants to do with whoever it is he wants to do it with? Vashti, you don't want to listen, you're out. Go gather all the other women together. Where's God as all of those other young women, whether Jewish or not, are being ripped away from their homes and saying, no, you're going to live at the king's house for the rest of your life to be at his beck and call. Where is God when the law is absent from the daily life? When the Jews have no temple to worship in? When there's no priest teaching in the temple? Where is God in all of this? One person said in their commentary, I don't know that it could have been said any better, the apparent absence of God is precisely the point. By not mentioning God's name, the author is inviting all of us to look for Him. Yet, I don't know about you, as I look for Him, what do I find? I struggle to find Him in these verses. But yet, as we dig deeper and deeper into the book of Esther, here's what you're going to find. He's everywhere. He's on every page. He might be hidden, but He's there all the time. God's ability to accomplish His purpose despite His hiddenness only heightens our sense of His power. No, this book is really just a long narrative that gives an illustration to Romans 8:28. For we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to His purpose. See, here is the truth of our text. God's omnipotently present even when He appears to be absent. See, God's not only present when He sends plagues. And God's not just present when His people are crossing the Red Sea. And God's not just present when manna is raining down. He is present in a drunken monarch's court. He is present as men make bizarre laws. He's present when a Jewish orphan girl is rounded up and used sexually by a pagan ruler. No, God is there and He's present even though He seems to be absent. And you say, what's all this have to do with me, preacher? Perhaps it's this. Perhaps you feel that the things that are going on in your life are just absolutely random. The things going on around you are just chaos and absurd. Perhaps something is going on or has happened in the past that makes the idea of God who directs all things seem unbelievable. You're keeping up with the world's news and you're going, I don't see where's God in this. As I struggle day after day with the same person at work, I'm wondering, where's God in this? I have a fight with my spouse and I wonder if my relationship is ever going to be fully restored. And I'm wondering, where is God in this? As we struggle with inflation, we struggle to get along with our mom and dad. We deal daily with our besetting sins. We're questioning, where's God? You look at all of these things that are going on in your life. You come to church and you're told by the preacher, God is at work in your life. Hang in there, God's at work. And you're going, preacher, that's hard to believe. What do you mean God's at work in my life? I've been searching for Him everywhere. I've been running to Him every day. I spent hours at this altar. I've been seeking after Him, and it's like He's a million miles away in the picture of my life and the picture of what's going on in my life. I know you say He's there and He's at work, but I keep staring at the picture, and I just can't seem to find Him. Wait. Again, listen to the message of our text this morning. God is omnipotently present, even when it appears He's most absent. Life is not random, though it feels like it is sometimes. Your life is not chaos, though living in a fallen world means that you will face incredibly chaotic times. God's activity in your life is not contingent on your perception of Him, but on His character and His promises. And He promises us that He will never leave us or forsake us. And so though, yes, it might be behind the scenes, and yes, it may be a long ways off, so far off that we can't see it, you can rest assured that whatever situation you're going through this very day, God is present, even if it appears He's absent. Life is not absurd. Life is not chaotic. Life is not random. God is always behind the scenes, fulfilling His promises, working out His plans, and doing His will. You might have to go a little ways in the book of Esther, scratching your head going, wait a second, where are You, God? But here's what you're going to find. The providential God of heaven is at work, putting Esther in the very place that God needs Esther to be for such a time as this. So here's my final and parting thoughts today. You're not here just by chance. It's not just some random, weird situation that led you to this service today. I believe, though you may not have seen it, you may not have seen how He's worked and all that He's been doing this week, I believe with all of my heart the providential hand of God has been moving and working to bring you to this very place you are today. One reason might be that you're not saved. If you're not 100% certain you're saved, He brought you here so that you could accept Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior and find a home in heaven. He brought you here for that today. You say, no, you show me how He did that. I may not be able to show you exactly where He is in the picture, but He's there. And He was working to bring you here today. God brought you here today so you can find help in your difficult hour. I don't know what you're going through. I've thrown out tons of illustrations this morning. It truly might be that you're just going to get up and go to work tomorrow and you're going to deal once again with that person you just can't barely stand. And you see them day after day after day after day. It might be that you're going to go back to a class and there's going to be a teacher there and you're just sure, and I'm convinced teachers do this. They've just got your number. They decided at the beginning of the year they don't like you and everybody else is going to get away with something, but you're not about to get away with anything. Everybody else can carry their phone, and if you carry your phone, they're taking it away. You're going to be in trouble. I'm just telling you, there are teachers that way, and you're like, I don't understand this. Of course, Keith is at Bible college. The boys struggled the first semester with a little thing they like to call demerits. He's like, wait a second. I don't live with mommy and daddy no more. I'm like, on my own paying for this. So demerits, this doesn't make much sense. Oh yeah, Bible college. And he has called me more than once, and he said, Dad, my dorm leader hasn't got a demerit all year. And he sent me pictures. He's like, look at his bed. Look at the mess that this boy has. Then look at my stuff. I get the demerit. He doesn't. His job was to take the trash out in the main kitchen area of the dormitory. That was his job. And so he'd get up every morning and he would take the trash out before he would go to class. While he was in class, everybody would clean their dorms, take the trash out of the dorms instead of taking it out the dumpster, put it in the trash cans that he's emptied, and he'd get wrote up for it every single day, like 5 demerits. So his coach calls him aside last week and is like, hey, bud, you don't stop with these demerits. You don't get to play basketball. They're going to shut this down. And he's like, that's the only reason I'm here, kind of, you know. I mean, you know, the ministry and learn how to be a preacher and all that. But, like, really, basketball's the main reason I came all the way out to Lancaster, California. There's a lot of other Bible colleges. He's like, well, you better stop. And he's like, Dad, how's this fair? Where's God in this? I can't tell him exactly what God's doing. I can't tell him why something that seemingly is unfair is happening to him. I don't know why your marriage is such a struggle. I don't know why you're struggling so much with your adult children. I don't know why they've ran away from God. And yes, I get it. It's hard to see God in that picture. You want them to be here with you and sitting next to you in church this day, and they don't want anything to do with God. They won't even talk to you at times. And you're going, God, where are you? I'm just telling you, he's there. And it might just be that the providential, seemingly random hand of God brought you to this auditorium today so you can find hope and say, if God can be there in the midst of everything Esther was going through and his people were going through under the wicked Ahasuerus, then God's certainly in my life. Look for God. Even though it might not seem like he's there, I'm just sure of it, like our Waldo picture. If you'll look long enough, if you look hard enough, in every picture of life, you'll see him. He's always there. Every head bowed, every eye closed.